Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Did You Read with Tim Montgomery.
Welcome to Did You Read, the latest edition of the Times Opinion podcast. My name is Tim Montgomery, and this week I'm joined by Susie Jagger, Patrick Kidd and Roger Boys.
Libya is at risk of fracturing into three fiefdoms, Tripoli in the west, Benghazi in the east, and Sabah in the south. Libya's enjoyed no stability since the overthrow of Gaddafi and points to a sobering third chapter of the Arab Spring, the first being uprising and coup, second nascent democracy, and third terrifying chaos. As the Middle East burns, literally, we have a foreign secretary with no foreign policy experience and a government with no foreign policy at all.
It's a hot summer. Wars in Syria, Iraq, Gaza, Ukraine, Afghanistan, trouble brewing in the South China Sea, Libya in flames. It hasn't been that bad for a century. All these flare-ups seem insoluble, so it's tempting to look away, do the Harold Macmillan thing, and shoot some grouse on the moors. But is all this killing really so difficult to stop?
Cameron's packing the latest Ben McIntyre book, Sensible Fellow. Miliband's sucking up to a Labour donor. Clegg's contemplating the resistance, and Farage, surprise, surprise, is obsessed with Brussels. But what does the holiday reading of our political leaders really reveal? And wouldn't it be better if they read less on holiday and more during the working week?
Well, I'm looking forward to your topic at the end, Patrick, because Susie and Roger have dished up some pretty gloomy fare for us for
some our war
first.
Everywhere.
War everywhere, yeah. So I think in a way, Susie's and Roger's topics might merge into each other a little bit. But Susie, let's start with your theme. And Libya was supposedly the limited foreign policy intervention to rescue interventionism. This was the intervention that David Cameron and Nicolas Sarkozy led. We didn't commit ground troops, but we provided the aerial cover, etc., to ensure that the people of Benghazi weren't massacred by Gaddafi. It looked okay-ish at the time of that intervention, but it really has descended into chaos now.
I think what it exposed is, A, we messed up because the Americans had to bail us out. The Americans, as you know, had sought to take a back seat in the no-fly zone.
Leading from behind was the expression.
Just for a change.
But by the end, what emerged was that America had to bail out Britain and France, that we messed up over it. And also the corollary of our intervention, or rather the corollary of assisting the rebels to overthrow Gaddafi, has shown that Libya is leading the trajectory of the next chapter of the Arab Spring. We're now in the third chapter of the Arab Spring. So we've gone from uprising and coups, overthrow of a government, which we saw in Tunisia, in Libya, only halfway, obviously, in Syria. And then the second stage, which was nascent democracy, which to an extent has sort of held in Tunisia and has collapsed in Libya. They've chased away two prime ministers, one of them literally fleeing the country. And now we're in a state of absolute anarchy. Turkey, kidnappings, the assassination of the American ambassador. There's no safety whatsoever. And it strikes me that this is a rather depressing foresight into perhaps how the rest of the Arab Spring region is going to project itself.
I do think it was partly because of the nature of how we intervened. We just gave the sort of militia groups, the tribal militia groups, the air cover to be able to be safe from Gaddafi's forces. But they were the people that basically toppled the regime, and they never had coherence, and they're at each other's throats. And is that part of the reason why Libya has failed?
I think it's that we had to make it up as we went along.
Yeah.
And I'd be very interested in Roger's view on this. But what struck me from the very beginning is that subject to the number of cuts within the Foreign Office, which is not Cameron's fault. This is just a process of how we've reduced what used to be an absolute class A diplomatic service.
Because the Foreign Office cuts have been about 50%, haven't they? Absolutely.
The
They're huge cuts.
And what Libya showed us, when Chris Prentice, who was then our man in Rome, who had to be brought back to Benghazi, is that we had an absolute paucity of Arabists. Mm. We simply didn't have the expertise to be able to put together what a foreign policy position should be on this rapidly changing Middle Eastern region.
So we didn't exactly learn the lessons of our lack of preparation in
Absolutely
Iraq.
Absolutely not.
I want to come back to your point about Philip Hammond in a minute or two, but Roger Boyd, Susie Jagger's made her case. Do you basically agree with it?
Well, yes, sort of. My main problem is with this sense of powerlessness that we have. That's been evident really since the Arab Spring began. We've been caught. That's, of course, why we're undernourished with Arabists, because it seemed like the Middle East was a forgotten area that we didn't really need all that much. And so we invested in Chinese speakers. Yeah, that's what's happened with the Foreign Office. But there is this sense of powerlessness, and you got it, and it does all hang together, because this was the feeling I got with William Hague pretty much 9 months, 10 months before his realignment or relocation. What's the human
sacking.
Resources? Sacking, thank you.
Well, I think he chose to go.
Yes, he chose to go.
Retirement.
Yeah, yeah. His early retirement, yeah. Anyway.
Which basically you called for in a column.
Yes,
A couple of months before he did actually go. So it was Roger what did it, I reckon.
Well, yeah.
And we're going off the thing.
Yeah. Anyway, the sense of powerlessness, basically, and we don't know how to deal with strong men. You know, one of the real mess ups of the Libyan intervention was the way that Gaddafi was killed and finished off. What kind of signal did that send to any other Arab state that we are trying to persuade to give up weapons of mass destruction, for example? It was a chaotic end.
You end up dead in a gutter.
You end up dead in a gutter, dropped by the people who had kind of bribed you.
Susie's desperate to come in.
Just on that point, Gaddafi was killed in the way in which I don't say it was appropriate, but he died in a way that was absolutely aligned with the regime and the theme of the regime and the brutality of a regime that he had dictated and structured in his own image for 40 years. There is an absolute irony that he died in that way, because that is how he'd set up his regime. I have no sense.
Well, I don't
think
there's any place for irony in foreign policy. I think that on the whole, one tries not to do eye for an eye, and that there were other ways of finishing the Libyan endgame that wouldn't have led to this present chaos.
The people to feel sorry for are the Libyan people.
What were those other ways, Roger?
Well, those ways would have involved some kind of tribal arrangement with our Arabists, you know, being
in the fore. And why wasn't that done? Because it was very hard, weren't we engaged?
We wanted to get out as fast as we could, you know, and that was it. That was the problem with this idea of liberal interventionism. It has to be short, in and out. And we were out. I'm not saying we should have supplied Gaddafi with bodyguards. He had enough kind of beautiful bodyguards as it was. But
we should have given
we weren't mourning
other
Gaddafi.
Dictators an exit plan is basically what you're
saying. Yes, there are different ways of doing it. Just as Frank, I was, now we're really straying, I was really against Obama's shooting of Osama bin Laden. I thought that was absolutely the wrong thing to do, an extrajudicial shooting.
Well,
maybe old-fashioned. I thought we should have wrapped him in a plastic bag and brought him back and put him on a trial like Eichmann in Israel. I think that's the way we should do things.
It would have been a huge rallying point if we had done that for jihadis.
Well, who cares? We would have still been true to our basic values. You can't run foreign policy as if it's a homeland script, you know.
One quick point. When you say we don't know how to deal with strong men, I would argue we don't actually know how to have strong foreign secretaries. On your point about Hague, Hague had four foreign policy speeches and there wasn't a single idea in any of them. I think you, one of the...
Well, he was big on rape. I mean, he was big on public diplomacy.
Big on opposing...
Sorry, opposing sexual violence
sexual
in war.
In war, yeah. Mm. Susie mentioned Patrick Kidd, William Hague giving four foreign policy speeches. And I think it was Fraser Nelson who said we have in William Hague perhaps the best orator in British politics, but he keeps giving speeches which say nothing at all, which may be a bit hard.
Well, Fraser Nelson also called William Hague the worst foreign secretary in a generation. I don't know if that was in the same piece, but in a piece recently. And I thought, gosh, well, we've had Margaret Beckett.
And I must say David Owen. And Douglas Hurd. I can make quite a long list, actually.
I suppose foreign secretary is only following the policy of the government or the Prime Minister taking lead, and perhaps David Cameron doesn't have too much of an interest in foreign politics.
He did seem to be, though, like this super diplomat, didn't he? He was always there shaking hands with global leaders.
Statesman-like.
And he looked the part and he made people sort of very welcome, but you weren't ever really sure what his goals were.
Well, Hillary Clinton in her new book calls him, was it the King of Toasting?
Yeah.
Emperor of Grilling or something, but that's all she has to say about him.
And now he's toast.
Yeah, we need a foreign secretary who is a bit more substance, I suppose. But I quite liked the fact that Hague looked like a foreign secretary, at least. But then I suppose Anthony Eden looked like a foreign secretary.
It's very Blairite of you. He's all about the look. back to your point, though, Susie Jagger, about Philip Hammond. You know, he, poor guy, becomes foreign secretary. I think 2 days afterwards, we had the shooting down of the Malaysian jet over eastern Ukraine. We've got the huge flare-up in Gaza, of course. We have ISIS still doing all that they are doing in Iraq, particularly against the Christian population. But he was defense secretary for, I think, 2.5-3 years. You know, he has got that sort of background. He's not starting looking at these global issues from with a blank piece of paper in front of him.
That's true, but he was supposed to be chief secretary to the Treasury. That's what he was always being lined up for.
Yeah, but that was 2010. That's a long, long time ago in politics.
He's a businessman.
Yeah.
He has no foreign policy experience, and I think it wouldn't be unfair to put a question mark over what he achieved in defence, apart from massive cuts, which are...
Well, he was loathed in the Ministry of Defence, but by the people...
But all defence, to be fair to him, all defence secretaries are loathed by the Ministry of Defence until they're finally pushed out.
Because
he was seen as an accountant.
But he's good precisely for that reason, because he now has to orchestrate a foreign policy that can no longer punch above its weight, partly because he's just sacked in his previous job 20,000 soldiers and helped to withdraw us from Afghanistan, Iraq, and indeed Germany. So it's a natural continuation of what he did. He's cut Britain's hard power.
Patrick, the truth is, isn't it, that Philip Hammond was brought in largely as a political move. He is the foreign secretary who will countenance, or has said he will countenance, Britain leaving the European Union.
It's all about Europe.
Nothing was happening on EU renegotiation, and Cameron wanted someone to send a message to UKIP voters, to his own backbenchers. This is the guy who you can trust to carry out a proper renegotiation.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Negotiation. And unfortunately, as Susie has sort of suggested, a foreign secretary does have to do other things than just look at Europe.
True, but a foreign secretary also has to sound and look right on the stage. Philip Hammond is such a cold fish that you could serve him with salmon and you aren't. He is utterly devoid of charisma. John Redwood looks lively and charming in comparison. And so I can't see...
You are a harsh man.
Yeah.
I can't see Philip Hammond doing those sort of... I mean, you talked about William Hague being very good at speeches, which he is, but I can't see him... Hammond quite doing that.
Do we want someone good at least on the Europe issue? Don't we just want someone who's going to get
Churchill won a war with speeches.
Someone just stuck into the detail of the European treaties. That's what Cameron wants from his foreign secretary. At
Right. He wants his foreign secretary to be interested in Europe, not Libya and the Middle East and stuff like that. And arguably Hammond, we suspect, is there as a placeholder until after the election when George Osborne, having saved the economy, will shift and save Europe. Well, that's his intention.
Susie?
Unfortunately, Cameron doesn't have a foreign policy. His foreign policy from the very beginning was based on trade, which was, you know, in a rather crass way, filling planes full of business people and flying them out to India. And I think that's the big problem. And I'm interested in Roger's view on this. That we
pig
have
sperm? He's selling pig sperm to the Chinese, isn't he? That's a big success.
That there's a vacuum of foreign policy position. We don't know what our position is in the Middle East.
I don't think that's such a terrible thing. I would like more thought put by the Conservative Party into foreign policy. You've got all these worthy terms from the Fabian Society and from the Labour Party in general about foreign policy, and almost nothing apart from Liam Fox on what we should be doing, what the party should be doing. But that's not really the point. I'm still with Harold Macmillan going grouse shooting during the Suez crisis, and I'm still with Edward Grey going fly fishing in the week before the First World War. There has to be a recognition, and I think that's a conservative thing too, about the limits of what you can actually do.
You talk about limits, Roger, but in your menu topic for us, you said, is all this killing really so difficult to stop? You seem to be more ambitious for our foreign policy than wanting to set limits. What is the Roger Boy's foreign policy?
Well, the difference is that I've changed overnight, basically.
You are like William Hague.
Yes, I'm very like William Hague in this respect. The thing is, wars end for all sorts of different reasons, and very rarely is it to do with our particular intervention. We have to find a way of dealing with strongmen leaders like Putin and Assad. We have to realize that they're heads of coalitions of interests, and we have to try and break them up, that they're not some kind of unassailable dictators who have food tasters and murder people in their bars. I mean, they are those things too, but there are ways of breaking up their power base and so on. You know, there are detailed ways, and mainly most wars are solved by timing. And the chances are that in 5 years' time, there won't be a repetition of a Gaza war. There'll be a different constellation of forces. We can already see it because...
You're talking like a Foreign Office diplomat now.
I'm not really sure where you're going with it. And I'm speaking English rather than
Arabic. I thought you were going to come with a plan of action for us to stop the killing.
A plan...
You're talking about constellations of circumstances.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you have got a plan here.
I think the campaign starts here. Lord Boys of Wapping. The next foreign secretary.
Yeah. Well, now I'm here, sadly, as diplomatic editor and not as God, so I can't really solve all those things.
I never
realised
the two positions were different.
I mean, my my point was simply, can we go to the beach and relax this summer or not? And I think my point is, well, yes, because there's not an awful lot we can do about all this bloodshed and killing. There are certain dynamics that are going to sort it out anyway.
Okay, but won't our sort of turning our back on all of this come back to
haunt
us?
We should stay interested.
Aren't these people that are killing Christians in Mosul, these people that are angry across the Middle East because of Israeli bombardments or Hamas's rocket fires, these people dying over eastern Ukraine, we can't isolate ourselves from all these events, pretend that... We can just enjoy our beach holidays, can we?
No, but we can't be their psychotherapists either, right? I mean, there's a lot to be said, frankly, for going to the beach and reading Tom Clancy.
Okay, well, I'm not convinced by this, but we will move. We will move on. And beach holidays and beach reading is your topic for us, Patrick. I think we need a change of tone.
Yes,
you're delighted with the Prime Minister's choice of reading, which is Ben McIntyre's latest book.
Well, but, I'm delighted for Ben because Ben's short of cash. As well.
what would you like our leaders to be doing? You'd like them to be reading more when they're here back in London, not just when they're on the beaches of Tuscany, Ibiza, yes. And all that.
Well, they were all asked by the Sunday Times to list five books that they would take on their extensively long holidays. And as the father of a child roughly the same age as Cameron's youngest and Miliband's too, I can't see them getting through five books, because when you're on holiday with a child, you're never going to. So it's a slight vanity exercise, and I'm sure their choices were focus groups, just as when Gordon Brown was asked for his favourite biscuit and had to go and ask around before coming up with an answer.
Was it Garibaldi?
I think he wanted something like a digestive in the end. Safe. Or maybe a hobnob. You can read, so Cameron.
A hobnob would have been Blesh.
Yeah. So, of course, we're looking for meanings. So very good. Cameron's gone for Ben McIntyre's book, A Spy Among Friends, which is about Kim Philby. All about betrayal, people say. Therefore, that's what we should look into. He's also gone for Baroness Trumpington's memoirs.
Which are brilliant.
Yeah. Yes, they're very good. And something to read with his daughter. Ed Miliband gets a lot of respect from me because he's only picked three books, which I think is much more realistic with two small children. But he's gone for the new Robert Galbraith, which is J.K. Rowling's pen name.
Oh, yeah.
I did wonder whether there was an Amazon cock up there, and he actually said, can I have something by J.K. Galbraith?
Yeah, that would sound like more.
No, it was a signal to Scotland. It was a pre-Scottish referendum.
She donates to the Labour Party. Yeah. He's also gone for Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is a 20-year-old novel, and Tristram Hunt's book. I won't read them all, but Clegg has gone
well,
for...
What's Tristram Hunt written about?
10 Cities That Made an Empire.
Okay.
Clegg's gone for a Paddy Ashdown book about the French Resistance called The Cruel Victory, which could apply to perhaps Clegg himself.
That's a bit creepy, his campaign manager's book.
Well, yes. He's gone for a couple of novels and David Attenborough's biography. And then Farage, bless him, can't stay away from Europe. He's gone for two books about Brussels, one called The Trouble with Europe, and one is Jonathan Hill's... account of the Maastricht vote.
Jonathan Hill, now who's that?
Well, he's the new EU musician. He's also gone for a couple of First World War books. Now, I mean, we can psychoanalyse this to death, but actually, my worry is that we no longer have politicians who make time during the working week to read. Harold Macmillan, you mentioned earlier, would always be going upstairs to
read Jane Austen.
Well, he famously got through the entire works of Jane Austen in one session and then went back and did it again. Mm. And he used to keep notes in his diary about what he'd been reading. John Major was very fond of tucking himself up with a trollop and a curry. I want my politicians to read more, to have background. They can be histories, they can be novels, anything that makes them think about other things. I'd quite like the first question in Prime Minister's Question Time. Will the Prime Minister tell us what he's reading, and does he like it? And then you can say, yes, I'm reading 50 Shades of Chris Grayling or something.
I want politicians who
do more than just be politicians. Yeah. But when you've got young kids on holiday, you're never going to read.
I saw on Twitter the other day someone suggesting that the ideal holiday reading for a politician was a book on how to be a special advisor. I thought, oh my goodness, that's so dry on the beaches. You don't really mind what they read, as long as it broadens their horizons. So history, fiction, it's just, you don't want them just to be lost in political textbooks. Is that right, Patrick?
Indeed. Yeah. I want them to know there's a world out there, and I want that to be more than just a holiday. I quite like Cameron to take an afternoon off to read from time to time.
Roger Boyce. It's a generational... You're right about the generational thing and how kids destroy reading patterns, aren't you? But and Harold Macmillan read the whole of Jane Austen because he was 70 years old. I would advise them just to catch up on their sleep and get some fresh air. I mean, I think that's much better for the brain than, you know, boring old printed words, you know. And it's certainly much better than the standard of political biographies. I was quite surprised in this list that there isn't a single... Is there a single political biography there? No,
there isn't.
Patrick doesn't want there to be political biography in there. He wants them to read other things.
Cameron's gone for a book on Gavrilo Princip, the assassin who started the First World War.
Yeah, that might be handy, of course. Yeah.
But no, there's Baroness Trumpington, I suppose, but that's fun rather than...
Susie Jagger, are you impressed with our politicians reading? Do you think, and do you think they're going to read these books over the summer?
No, I was going to say, I'm pretty cynical about it. I mean, the amount of political branding that goes into this. I remember seeing a picture, I think it was last summer, of Ed Miliband going on holiday with a stack full of the most tedious political theory books. and I thought, well, what is the message that you're trying to put out on this? Is it that you're even more dull and boring than we thought you were? Or is it just that you're even more...
Who's more dull then? Are we Philip Hammond or Ed Miliband? That seemed to be the big debate issue of the podcast now.
That's a dirty question.
Anyway, I'm interrupting your flow. I'm sorry.
No, I just think that the extent to which the political leaders are manicured and presented to us as a brand and as an image is now so complex and is now so polished that you're never going to know what these people are reading.
Are being authentic, we have become so cynical now. We think it's all so stage managed and spun. We don't believe.
I think so.
What they're in this? And do you, Patrick, believe that when the Sunday Times contacted the leaders' offices and said, please give us your five books, Ed Miliband actually drew and David Cameron drew these lists out, or were they written up for them by advisors?
Well, I am a bit cynical about it, in the same way that when they go on Desert Island Discs, quite. They ask around them. Miliband was on recently. Yes, had.
No one, was it David Cameron chose? He chose that Milkman tune, didn't it?
Ernest, the fastest
Milkman in the world. Well, no advisor could have chosen that for him.
Well, when Ed Miliband went for Aha, didn't it?
Wasn't that something that he, one of his first songs, was it Justine, or that was
something like that?
Yeah. Oh, Justine, because of, yes, I see. Yeah. Mm.
What's your holiday reading, Tim?
Oh, I'm not going away until the early September, so can I answer then? And actually,
you're going to have it focus grouped.
I'm going to have it focus grouped, yes. And perhaps you draw up the list for me, Patrick. Patrick, Roger, Susie, we should probably finish there. We will be back next week for our final podcast of the season, and then we will, some of us, be taking our various breaks. All it leaves me to do is to thank Dave Maguire for producing this podcast. And if you'd like to read some articles as background to what we've been discussing, including Roger Boy's call for William Hague to go a couple of months ago, and I think we should link to your Sunday Times lists of book reading, Patrick, then please, as if you're a Times subscriber, go to thetimes.co.uk/commentcentral and you can access those links. Until next week, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.